Hello and welcome to Behind the News. My name is Doug Henwood. Order in the universe has been restored as we return to the usual two-guest lineup. Pankaj Mishra talks about, among other things, the Holocaust in Israeli identity, and Nancy Fulbray takes account of unpaid household labor. First, a correction of a mistake I made last week. In the course of describing a review of Abigail Schreier's new book, Bad Therapy, in Compact Magazine, I said its author, the sociologist Frank Furedi, is the guru of a formation that originated as the Socialist Workers' Party, UK. It most definitely was not the Socialist Workers' Party. Sorry, I should have said Revolutionary Communist Party, which is no relation to the American Party of the same name. The British RCP prided itself on contrarian positions like opposing the 1985 miners' strike. It eventually morphed into Spiked, the libertarian website and conference sponsor that has gotten some funding from the right-wing Coke ATM. RCP, not SWP. Apologies. Pankaj Mishra wrote an excellent long essay based on a lecture, The Shoah After Gaza, which is in the current print edition of the London Review of Books, and was posted to their website back in February. It took some time to catch up with him, but here he is for the Behind the News audience. It's an incredibly rich analysis of the use of the Holocaust, not merely in justifying Israel's brutal wars against its neighbors, starting with the Palestinians it displaced 75 years ago, but also in creating the modern Israeli identity. Mishra recalls that the Shoah was not talked about much in the early decades after World War II, either in the US, Europe, or Israel itself. It didn't really enter discourse in a major way until the 1970s. Some of Israel's early political figures were even contemptuous of survivors of the genocide. Quoting Mishra, Israel's first prime minister, David Ben-Gurion, initially saw Shoah survivors as human debris, claiming they had survived only because they had been bad, harsh, egotistic. It wasn't until years later, the late 1970s under Prime Minister Menachem Begin, that the Nazi extermination project was mobilized to become a cornerstone of Israeli identity. Remarkably, Ronald Reagan was so scandalized by Begin's invasion of Lebanon in 1982 that he told him to stop the Holocaust, a word that Reagan said he chose deliberately to shock Begin, turning the word back on its manipulator. Just imagine Biden making such a phone call. Another important point in Mishra's history is the discomfort many prominent Jews felt at the time of Israel's founding. They feared it would turn into an armed camp oppressing and displacing Palestinians, and their fears were all realized. I urge people to read the essay. It's first rate. You can find it on the London Review of Books website, lrb.co.uk. Pankaj Mishra is an essayist and novelist whose books include Age of Anger, A History of the Present, and Run and Hide. Pankaj Mishra. Early Israeli views of Holocaust survivors weren't very generous, were they? Could you remind us what they were like? Ben-Gurion had some nasty things to say.
No, because I think they were seen as shameful evidence that Jews had been robust enough in combating their enemies. Mind you, I was just reading a biography of Zygmunt Bauman. And these attitudes actually were also there in the late 60s when he moved to Israel from Poland. Again, he came up against this prejudice of, oh, people from a part of the world from Poland where Jews had meekly gone to their deaths. So that was a prevailing prejudice, certainly in the late 40s. And then, as I say, persisted for long afterwards.
What changed that? Menachem Begin had something to do with it.
I'm not sure. I mean, it's hard to say, obviously, whether attitudes broadly shifted or became more sympathetic. You have to remember that Holocaust survivors also started to die at some point. But what changed certainly was the national ideology of Israel became more closely affiliated with this narrative of victimhood. That was Begin's contribution to this. I mean, obviously, people had brought this up in the past, but he was the one to actually give it institutional form, this ideology of the Holocaust as essentially justification for whatever the state of Israel does. That was his innovation.
At the same time, in the West, the Holocaust initially in the early post-war decades was not paid that much attention to, but then that started changing in the late 60s, right? What happened in the West?
Yeah, it's interesting to remember today that there was no such thing as the Holocaust. The category did not exist for a long time after 1945. The killings of the Jews, the mass murder of the Jewish population of Europe, was not seen as an atrocity separate from, you know, the many other atrocities of the war. And, you know, one has to also remember, I suppose, that there were tens of millions of people dead in 1945. The Soviet Union alone had about, you know, more than 20 million dead. So back then, you know, if you were amongst the countries, if you're living in one of the countries that had suffered from the war, you were not so prone to look at this particular category or think about it too much, the category of the Holocaust. It was a later construction, a later idea, and public awareness of it, of course, came even later. Public awareness in the United States, I mean, most historians have said it really only came in the late 70s with the broadcasting of the television program, The Holocaust. And that is also true, apparently, for Germany, that Germans really had their sort of first public mass exposure to the ugly realities of what their ancestors had done when they first saw this American series. And likewise in, you know, many other countries, especially countries, I think, where there had been high degree of collaboration with Nazis, that awareness never really fully arrived. I mean, I'm thinking also of states that were then ruled by communist regimes who had their own reasons for not emphasizing the murder of Jews, and, you know, who kind of insisted that the fight against Hitler was a fight against fascism. So they had their own particular narrative. It suppressed the Holocaust.
Begin worked with darker Israeli Jews and worked with their resentment of their maltreatment at the hands of the European Jewish elite. By reading that, I was reminded of some of the things that the planter class did in the U.S. South, working with the poor whites. Tell us a little bit about how Begin did some of that propaganda work.
I use the phrase there, the wages of Israeliness, which is, you know, a phrase inspired by the famous book called Wages of Whiteness, about precisely how American racism offered the poorest of the whites the chance to feel socially superior to the most wretched in that particular society, and that was the African-American population. We see this dynamic playing out in different parts of the world. As I speak, it's playing out in India, where the Prime Minister, Mr. Modi, has created a very broad platform for himself and his party by offering to low-caste Hindus a chance for social mobility. And how's that social mobility achieved? It's achieved by turning them against the weakest and the poorest members of the population, which happen to be Muslims. So we've seen this kind of ideological, rhetorical, and very successful maneuver in country after country. And obviously in the 70s, Israel was also ripe for a demagogue like Begin to come in and exploit the racial tensions there and create this new narrative which could bind this very, you know, loosely imagined community into a much more cohesive Israeli community.
You recount a conversation between Biden and Menachem Begin when Biden shocked Begin with his bloodthirstiness. I was really taken aback by that. But watching Biden now, I guess it's not that surprising. This is a longstanding position of his.
It is, and it's really fascinating to the extent to which certain U.S. presidents, we also observe that tendency in certain European leaders in different degrees, in different historical contexts. There was a generation of British politicians back in the early 20th century who were fervent Zionists because they were obsessed with the Old Testament. In the case of Lyndon Johnson, and there was another reason for his very great sympathy for the state of Israel. And with Biden, again, there's a particular social, emotional formation there. And obviously, this is also a president who came into close contact with the cult of Elie Wiesel, which you might remember was really very, very powerful back in the 80s and 90s, and that's a time when Biden, you know, kind of entered politics and became prominent in U.S. politics.
Yeah, those quotes from Alfred Cateson about Elie Wiesel are pretty surprising.
I think, you know, a lot of people possess that opinion of Wiesel. I mean, you know, this is obviously suppressed by the cult of Elie Wiesel. In many of Cason's other writings, there are accounts of him hanging out with Elie Wiesel and finding him quite unbearable and quite also finding him, interestingly, quite unreliable. There's a quote in his diary where he says he thinks Wiesel lies a lot of the time. There's a very interesting account of him meeting with Elie Wiesel and Saul Bellow. I don't know whether it's in his diaries, but it's in one of his books. It may be in New York Jew, actually, the book that Alfred Cason authored, with Golda Meir, the Israeli prime minister, and listening to Elie Wiesel talk. And it's a fantastically interesting account of this peculiar dynamic of Elie Wiesel, the Holocaust survivor, going on and on about his experience and this sort of various profundities that come pouring out of his mouth. And Cason is sitting there, Saul Bellow is sitting there, laughing, making jokes. It's a very interesting scene. But I think it's, again, you know, expresses the certain kind of skepticism that Cason and others came to have about Elie Wiesel.
Watching Biden now, it's shocking to recall that Ronald Reagan, of all people, told Begin to stop his Holocaust in Lebanon. It's impossible to imagine an American president doing that or saying that. And Reagan in his diary said he chose that word deliberately.
Yes. I mean, I suppose, again, you know, it shows how there was a time when American presidents could take certain decisions without fear, without the apprehension that they might be damaging their political chances or damaging their electoral chances. Well, Biden is doing that right now in a different way. But I think we all know that the influence of the Israel lobby groups has been so strong for decades now that it's very, very difficult for U.S. presidents, even Barack Obama had to admit defeat at the hands of AIPAC. In the case of Biden, of course, you know, there is that extra sort of indoctrination that he clearly received from people like Elie Wiesel and others. So there's a sort of ideological element to his unconditional solidarity with Israel.
Going back to the evolution of Israeli attitudes, some of the early critics of the really bellicose turn of Zionism were themselves either survivors of or witnesses to the Holocaust. It recovers some of that forgotten history for us.
There were lots of people back then who had, if not actually spent time in the death camps, but you know, at least were caught in those horrific events in Poland and Ukraine and the Soviet Union, who were instinctively anti-Zionist. Actually, obviously, I can't possibly mention all of these people in the lecture I wrote, but the person that comes to mind is Viktor Klemperer. Now, Viktor Klemperer is famous for the diaries he kept while living in Nazi Germany. And these diaries are actually, I mean, incredibly valuable testimony to someone describing daily existence in Nazi Germany during those, you know, terrible years in the 30s and 40s. Now, what's interesting about Klemperer, which again, a lot of people who invoke him as a great witness don't talk about, is how militantly anti-Zionist he is. And then he maintains his position. After the war, he goes to live in East Germany. And he's constantly talking in his diaries and his other writings about how Zionism, I mean, he goes really much further than a lot of these critics. I mean, Primo Levi and Jean Améry started to frame their criticism in the late 70s or early 80s. But the comparisons to Nazism are already being made by Viktor Klemperer in the 40s and 50s. At some point, he's recounting an argument with someone who's just come back from Israel, a German Jewish person who had moved to Israel and then moved back to Germany because he was so disgusted by the way Israelis were treating Arabs. This is, mind you, in the 1950s. And Klemperer says that, the Israelis treating the Arabs badly are as bad as the Nazis. And then he corrects himself, because obviously this is an exaggeration, and says, well, it's still pretty bad. There are people already being very critical of Israel at a time, and these are survivors, these are witnesses, at a time when there's really very little even information or awareness of what is going on between Israelis and Arabs in the 1950s. You know, all this comes to the attention of the world only in the late 1960s, with 1967, there's a sort of broader awareness of what's going on in that particular region. So there are lots of histories of this kind, personal histories, social histories of an opposition to Zionism, and of course going back, 1920s and 30s. I mean, what's amazing, truly amazing, is that Zionism should become the default position of so many people today, when in fact anti-Zionism was the default position of some of the most intelligent and talented people.
It's interesting, though, to see a return to the anti-Zionism, at least among younger American Jews these days. It's for me, someone of my age, it's really striking to watch this evolution, because 10 years ago, that would have been unimaginable.
Yes, I suppose, younger people today have seen or witnessed a transformation of the Zionist project into a version that they recoiled from. And I suppose this is a version that all those survivors and witnesses were warning against right from the 1940s onwards, people like Hannah Arendt or Einstein, that this is what's going to happen. And unfortunately, many of those prophecies have been fulfilled. It's something that young people have witnessed in their own lifetimes, and they're right to reject it and to ask for something better.
I'm speaking with the essayist and novelist Pankaj Mishra. You have an interesting quote from 1980 from the Israeli columnist Boaz Evron on the role that Israel and Israeli Jews play in the imaginations of American Jews. The virile superman, at the same time, victim. And that combination of victim and hero has pervaded the mythology around Israel for decades now. Talk some about this role of Israel in the imagination of the American Jewish community.
There are also later studies of the close connection between America and Israel. I mentioned one of them in a previous article I wrote on this subject by Alice Kaplan, Our American Israel, which goes even deeper into this very fascinating bond between the Jewish American population and Israel. Mind you, again, I mean, I think there's a danger of seeing this as something distinctive, as something peculiar to the Jewish American population. And again, one has to sort of, broaden one's perspective and see that expatriate communities or communities that have been away from what they come to think of as their home for a long time often have these relationships. I mean, I'm thinking of the Indian communities in the United States today, in the way their attitudes have evolved from indifference to India to an intense involvement with it. And it's because of the way in which society in America has evolved, how it has placed a greater premium on ethnic identity. And the same is true of both Indian Americans and Jewish Americans. I would like this to be seen in a broader perspective, and not just Jewish Americans, but this is a dynamic peculiar to American society, that it always has people who are very emotionally attached to a country or a cause or a political cause that's thousands of miles geographically distant from them. I mean, Ireland is another example of this, obviously, and the support for the IRA.
You mentioned briefly the role of Modi. Are there parallels between Zionism and Hindu fundamentalism and supremacy that Modi perpetrates?
Yes, very striking parallels. I mean, I think, both of them emerge around the same time. And in fact, in my book, Age of Anger, I kind of trace the parallel trajectories of the sort of intellectual godfather of revisionist Zionism, Vladimir Jabotinsky, and also the Indian ideologue, the kind of father figure of Hindu nationalism, which is Vinayak Savarkar. And both in their different ways seek a kind of manly identity for their respective communities. They despair over the lack of unity that they see amongst Hindus and Jews, and they want to bind them into a new militaristic, determined, resolute formation, political formation. And they are constantly looking for alliances, useful alliances. And in both cases, they turn to the British, even though they realize that the British are actually oppressors, the British are actually in physical occupation of the countries where they want their homeland. But nevertheless, they think, you know, the British can be of help to them. There are those kinds of historical similarities. There are definitely certain psychological similarities. And then, of course, the similarities deepen when those projects start to manifest themselves in nation states. And then, of course, you know, the revisionist versions, the militant versions of Zionism start to become dominant in the 1970s onwards. In India, they don't become dominant until much later. But again, you can see a particular sort of trajectory. And as I mentioned earlier, the national narratives are revised and they are infused with particular sort of tensions and aggressions, like Begin using racial antagonisms to create a new narrative, or Modi using caste antagonisms to strengthen his national narrative. So there are a lot of things going on there which we need to study closely.
There's a curious laundering of the Nazis' reputation going on right now. We hear these people saying Hamas is worse than Hitler. The real crime was actually Bolshevism. How do you read that?
Well, this is, you know, something that obviously has been with us for a very long time. These kinds of theories. Let's not forget that the idea that all Jewish people are Bolsheviks and therefore they need to be eradicated was one of the ideas, one of the most murderously influential ideas in Germany and Eastern Europe for, you know, much of the first half of the 20th century. So depending on particular political context, these kinds of prejudices, extreme prejudices that can result in extreme violence become dominant. Fortunately, they're not dominant in our present moment. There is, of course, a fringe minority that keeps saying these kinds of things. And thanks to unregulated, unfiltered forms of digital media today, they find large audiences. But I don't really see too much sign of them in the political or journalistic mainstream.
During this war in Gaza, it seems that Western support has been, if anything, more intense than usual. The critics ostracized, even, you know, expressions of dissent being criminalized. Where is this severe reaction coming from, do you think?
Well, it's coming from a sense of panic. You know, I think there is a certain narrative that's been maintained because many people in journalism, certainly, and you know, By and large, in the public sphere, not much scrutiny was made of this particular narrative, which was, you know, support for Israel, unconditional support for Israel over decades and decades and decades. And the reason why this narrative lasted for as long as it did, now it's falling apart before our eyes, is because all the potential challenges to it had been diffused. So you couldn't really talk about it in academia without being penalized. And we know of cases. I mean, the, you know, original cancel culture was deployed against people who tried to speak frankly about this issue. And we've known this for a very long time. So what has happened now is because the scale of atrocities committed by the Israeli government, the current Israeli far-right regime in Gaza, so exceeds the worst fears of everyone, including, you know, the greatest supporters of Israel, that it's become impossible to control the narrative, to maintain the narrative, or maintain the old narrative. Hence, the desperation and panic, the attempts to censor, to suppress, to marginalize, to stigmatize, So I think you have to see this dialectically, that there is a very wide sense of fear and panic right now, that the old narrative is falling apart, is being shredded. And it's, you know, what is helping shred it are direct accounts of atrocity being broadcast on videos, in images from Gaza by sometimes Israeli soldiers themselves. So it's become almost impossible, no matter how much the New York Times spins this, no matter how much the mainstream press spins it, people have access to unfiltered information about the atrocities in Gaza today. So that narrative really has no chance of surviving this moment.
The crackdown on speech seems most severe in Germany, which is, I guess, comes out of the early German post-war reaction to the Holocaust, which was a very bizarre and extreme philo-Semitism. Could you talk about that evolution?
That's a very long history. I mean, I think, you know, what's happening in Germany today is more complicated than that. I mean, obviously, they've decided that they really cannot bear too much complexity at this point about too much scrutiny into their past. So the only way in which they can remain good Germans is by supporting Israel, no matter what happens. And this is a policy, obviously, in 6 months' time, has proven to be morally completely disastrous and untenable, even for fanatical members of the Green Party, who are most vociferous in their support for Israel. So again, I think there's a crisis there. I mean, the German government, the German political class, says that Israel's security is one of our essential national duties. But Israel's security is not the same as Netanyahu's security. So if you're supporting Netanyahu, in many ways, you're undermining the security and legitimacy of the state of Israel. And such is their kind of single-minded, or you might say mindless, dedication to Israel, is that they haven't really seen the difference yet, that supporting Israel might also mean supporting Israeli policy of starving Palestinians in Gaza. They're unable to see it because they're so trapped, they're so frozen in their postures of unconditional solidarity with Israel.
And finally, the grotesque exploitation of the Holocaust to justify genocide has really debased the memory of one of the most significant events in modern history. Should that be recovered? Is maybe solidarity with Gaza a way to do some of that work?
Well, I think this is really, I mean, in many ways, this is a kind of moral calamity that we are faced with, you know, because the Holocaust, unprecedented crime, has been in many ways the memory of it, the memory of the atrocities committed against Jewish population of Europe and the sort of experience of Jewish prejudice against Jewish people, has been for such a long time a cautionary tale for all of us. Whenever we hear expressions of extreme prejudice, whenever we encounter expressions of radical ideology, we are constantly remind ourselves, we remind ourselves and we remind others of what happened when we heard something similar back in the 1930s. But by instrumentalizing the Holocaust in the cynical way the Israeli regime has, it really has deeply, deeply cheapened the meaning of the Holocaust for so many people around the world. And I think in many ways, the people, the young people in particular, who are out on the streets, demonstrating, disrupting routine politics, disrupting cultural events, and demanding that attention be paid to the victims of the Israeli military in Gaza. They are the ones, I think, who have emerged as the true custodians of the memory of the Holocaust. They are the ones who have been warning for months now against the risks of genocide, against the risks of famine, against the risks of starvation. And it's them that history will eventually vindicate. And perhaps this is one way that we can keep alive this memory of the monstrous crimes committed against Jews in the mid-20th century.
That was the essayist and novelist Pankaj Mishra. You can find the essay, The Shoah After Gaza, on the London Review of Books website, lrb.co.uk. My name is Doug Henwood, and the program is Behind the News, back after a musical break. That was some of the Arietta from Beethoven's Piano Sonata No. 32, performed by the great Maurizio Pollini, who died on Saturday the 23rd at the age of 82. Next, unpaid domestic work. Bourgeois society generally, and its economists especially, value labor by the monetary values it generates. That renders domestic labor, cooking, cleaning, care of children, the sick, and the elderly, invisible, even though society would grind to a halt almost immediately without it. Over the last few decades, economists, mostly the feminist sort, have been trying to quantify just how much work is involved in these efforts of social reproduction and who is doing it. An ambitious new exercise in quantifying domestic labor has just been published by the Levy Economics Institute at Bard College. It was commissioned by the Bureau of Labor Statistics, the BLS, to help the agency incorporate domestic production into its annual consumer expenditure survey. That survey examines how much people spend on what in a year. The mix of expenditures is used to construct the Consumer Price Index, also compiled by the BLS. Here is one of the report's authors, the distinguished feminist economist Nancy Fulbray. The others are Ajit Zacharias, Fernando Rios Avila, and Thomas Masterson, with more on the project. She is a professor emeritus of economics at UMass Amherst and a fellow of the Levy Institute. She's been researching and writing about care work for decades. Nancy Fulbray. Let's start just with some logistics here. How did this study come to be?
Well, it came to be, I would say, because there's a growing interest in the economic value of unpaid work, which clearly affects people's living standards and what they're able to consume. And a big problem is that none of the existing surveys really collect information about the whole care package or unpaid work package. There's one survey that looks at time use. There's another survey that looks at expenditures. And there's another study that looks at utilization of government programs. And, you know, there are various other little surveys that look at different dimensions of that. But there's no survey that really allows you to see what the relationship is between time and money and government services. So the BLS commissioned this very heroic effort to combine data from three surveys. Actually, like I think five or six surveys were ultimately involved, but to kind of construct a synthetic picture that would help researchers understand the relationship between these three components.
Now, a lot of the paper is devoted to the techniques you used to put all this together, well beyond the scope of a radio show for a general audience. But can we just say that this was no simple matter?
Well, I think it is really important to point out that the whole purpose of the BLS project was to make data available to researchers. And so as the authors, you know, we were really trying our best to make it inviting for a new cohort of researchers who are interested in these topics to get in there and crunch the numbers. That's why there's so much, you know, brouhaha in the report.
Economists have been at this for decades. What do you bring to the party that's unique or adds to the effort?
Well, you know, even though economists have been looking at unpaid work for a long time, they've been very reluctant to actually consider it work. That is to assign it any economic value. And as a result, we have this policy vocabulary that treats work as identical with paid employment. So mothers who are at home raising three kids are not really working. And so if they get any benefits, they must be free riding on taxpayers, et cetera. Basically, a small group of researchers has been working really hard to insist on better measurement and plausible estimates of the value, and then consideration of the substitutability between public and private expenditures and services. Of all the surveys that are discussed that are used in the survey in the report, the one I'm most familiar with is, I think, the most interesting. It's the American Time Use Survey.
Why do you say that?
Well, because it's been conducted on an annual basis since 2003, and it asks a nationally representative sample of people what they did all day, 24 hours in the day. What time did you wake up? What were you doing? What did you do after that? Then what did you do? Et cetera, et cetera. It provides a really accurate picture of the amount of time that people devote to work that they could, in principle, have paid somebody else to do for them.
Unpaid household labor is enormous, and we'll get to how enormous in a moment. And most of this work is done by women, I think, over three quarters in your estimate. Now, your paper is based on data from 2019, pre-COVID, but what other general trends in the gendered division of household labor over time? Are men doing more or not?
Yeah, over time, there have been some changes. They're actually pretty small. Women are doing a little bit less housework, and men are doing a little bit more housework. Women are doing a little bit more active care. That's things like feeding, bathing, talking to, reading aloud to kids. But they're spending a little bit less time with children or supervising children, which is a really important component of our considerations in the report.
And what about non-market household production generally? We've come a long way from when people grew their own food and made their own clothing and furniture. what do these trends look like over time?
Well, what are people doing? I know. It's sort of amazing, isn't it? To me, it's just absolutely astounding that in the U.S. today, people spend about as much time on average on paid work as on paid work. It's partly because we have a lot of retired people. It's partly because students are spending more time in unpaid work than paid work, especially if you consider studying unpaid work, which technically it usually isn't. It's true, people aren't cooking from scratch, but people are spending more time kind of managing things, right? Going shopping, having to be home while somebody comes to fix the furnace, managing childcare, juggling elder care and work responsibilities. Just the composition of unpaid work has changed. So, you know, less time cooking and housework, more time kind of managing and shopping and also driving around. It turns out that one of the biggest components of childcare today is driving kids around.
You try to assign a monetary value to all this labor. How do you settle upon a wage rate to assign to it?
Well, in the report, we tried to pick a kind of lower bound estimate, what's called a generalist wage rate for people who provide household services. And that's the most common wage rate used. It's a very low wage rate. But we also argue that we would do better to use occupation-specific wage rates for different activities, like a preschool teacher's wage for certain kinds of active care of kids, or a nurse assistant's wage for care of the elderly in need of assistance. So our purpose was to, you know, again, because we wanted to really invite researchers in to use this data, whatever their assumptions, we provided a range of estimates using different wage rates, and also including both just regular active childcare and then also adding in the measurement and evaluation of supervisory care, which is actually also available in the American Time Use Survey. And that ends up to be very consequential. The time that people spend actually physically interacting with kids is relatively small compared to the amount of time that's constrained by the need for some adult to be on call and nearby to supervise them, even if they're playing in the backyard or in another room.
So they don't burn down the house.
Exactly.
That's good all those days. Now, childcare is woefully underpaid. How do you deal with that?
Well, we tried to deal with it by using a preschool teacher's wage rather than a childcare worker's wage. And we do explain in the report that we view childcare workers' wages as not only unconscionably low, but really inaccurately low. I mean, really not consistent with what childcare workers get in other countries or in other labor markets. So I think there's a pretty rich discussion there about how not to let the low market wage rates for either childcare or elder care bias our results.
I came across a factoid years ago that really stuck with me ever since, that parking lot attendants are paid a higher wage than childcare workers, which says something about American society.
And guess what? Animal trainers are paid more too.
Good Lord. Keep this up, it'll depress me. Okay, now let's go to some of your findings. Obviously, children, the presence or absence of children in the household make a big difference. What share of households and how much of a difference are we talking about here?
I think the most interesting finding from our report is that if you look at households in the bottom half of the income distribution, the value of their unpaid work is about equal to the amount of money they spend buying stuff, their expenditures, the portion of their income that goes to expenditures for consumption. I mean, basically their consumption is doubled, effectively doubled by the care that they provide for household members and the unpaid household work they do. And yes, as you point out, really big differences between households with children and households without, because quantitatively, the amount of time devoted to childcare, supervisory care in particular, is really, really high.
On the face of it, the share of household spending devoted to food looks relatively smallish, especially compared to what it was at one time. But what happens to the share of spending on food when you add in unpaid tasks like shopping, cooking, and cleanup?
Yeah, that's a good question. There used to be this really clear distinction between food at home and food away from home. Like one was something that your mom cooked and the other one was something that you went to a restaurant and sat down and ate. But now a lot of food that is actually eaten at home was prepared in the supermarket. You know, whether it's rotisserie chicken or premixed salad or whatever, the whole process of meal preparation has been industrialized in ways, and that's really led to big reductions in the amount of time, average time that people spend on food. So I don't think that food preparation per se adds a lot to the total today.
I'm speaking with the economist Nancy Fulbray. Add it all up, if you impute monetary values to all this household labor you're talking about, what does it do to household spending?
Here's the rub. You can't really answer that question with this data, because what you really want to know, or what I've really wanted to know, and I'm trying to figure out with some other data sources, is to what extent there's a trade-off between time and expenditures. You know, like how much does an extra $100 reduce the amount of time that you spend in unpaid work? But since none of the surveys contains that data on the individual household level, and it's all just imputed statistically, you can't really examine substitutability in this data set on the household level. But one thing that is really surprising that I've learned from different data set called the Panel Study of Income Dynamics is that, and I find this really startling, is that there really is virtually no relationship between the amount of time people spend in unpaid work and their family income.
Yeah, that was very interesting. That's not what one would expect.
No, it's not. It's not. And I think what it speaks to is the fact that low-income people and high-income people are doing different kinds of household production activities. But I agree. It sort of goes against the notion that poor people are able to make up for their low income by doing more unpaid work. But, you know, there's kind of a limit. there's basically kind of a technological limit to the extent to which you can increase your actual living standard with unpaid work, right? I mean, it's not really practical for people to grow their own food or to make their own clothes or to fix their own cars, et cetera, et cetera. So there are many people who would really like it if they had things to do around the house that were even more productive and allowed them to increase their standard of living even further. But, you know, there's just not as much substitutability as you might think, except with childcare. There's a lot of substitutability. That is, if you can pay for somebody to care for your young child or for that matter, for a family member who's got a disability or illness, that really does cut down on the amount of care time, especially supervisory care time that you need. That's where the substitutability lies.
Yeah, I once heard of a takeover artist, a celebrity guy from the 80s who's still around these days, still in the news these days, who had 8 children, each of whom had his or her own nanny. And there are three layers of management between parents and children. So, I mean, that's one approach, but that's not easily replicable, is it? If you add in all this unpaid labor, the value of this unpaid labor, what does this do to the inequality picture?
Yeah, I think that is such an interesting question because in the crest section, in one point in time, it has an equalizing effect. And the reason it has an equalizing effect is not that poor people do more of it, but that they do more of it relative to their money income. So you're adding a large quantity of something that's identical at the top and the bottom, and that's diminishing the variation between the top and the bottom. So sometimes people get cranky with me because they think that this research implies that I'm going to make poor people look better off. And that's not the right conclusion, because if you apply this method consistently and you look back in time and ask what the trends are, the trend towards inequality is actually amplified. And the reason it's amplified is pretty simple. The percentage of households that have a full-time homemaker has gone way down. And because those homemakers were the ones who were equalizing things, they're equalizing effect has diminished a lot over time.
And then what about the tendency of people of similar socioeconomic status to marry in these days of, two paycheck households? What does that do?
That comes in too. That's another reason that inequality in earnings, and we know and have been able to measure how much of the overall inequality in earnings comes from what's called assortative mating, basically high earners marrying high earners. And if you think about it, there's just a lot more inequality in women's earnings than there is in the value you would assign to the time they spend in childcare or housework. I think that's a better appreciated factor in the overall trend towards income polarization.
Whenever monetary values are imputed to non-monetary activities, I stumble sometimes. Now, I get why you're trying to do it, trying to estimate the magnitude of these things, render incomparable values comparable. But there's something different about the world of money. It's impersonal in its brutality, work or starve, as opposed to the domestic sphere, where there is certainly plenty of discipline and coercion, quite often. But it can be obscured by sentiment and notions of duty. Any thoughts on how these two realms compare?
Yeah, I think that it's a really important point. And we always want to emphasize that with an imputation, we're looking at a lower bound. We're looking at a minimum valuation that doesn't include consideration of the person's specific skills and capabilities that are typical of family work. But I think it's also true, and this is something that I've learned from looking at wages and working conditions and paid care work. The same thing is true there, that a lot of teachers and nurses and childcare workers and elder care workers have a strong sense of obligation towards their patients. And in fact, their kind of moral and emotional commitment is often the only thing standing between the corporate bottom line and the quality of care that's being provided. So I think instead of picturing a kind of binary, like here's the home and it's the place of love and obligation and altruism, and here's the market and it's the realm of self-interest and greed and dysfunction, I think we need to see a more graduated continuum where there's a sector of the economy that provides paid care services that actually has pretty personal dimensions to it.
Now, there's a brand of apology for gender discrimination that says that women get these non-monetary rewards, the rewards of care and affection for low-paid work like childcare and preschool teaching and such. That's a common and bogus excuse, isn't it?
It's so common. I'm so tired of it. I can't tell you how often I hear it. It's still, it's like a slogan, oh, that's just compensating differentials. Oh, well, they must really like it. The example I like to offer in the face of that is that a lot of really highly paid people really, really like their jobs. And there's no evidence that the pay that people get is determined by whether they like or dislike their jobs. It's one of many, 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 many factors. If you look at CEO pay, CEO pay has increased something like 1,000 times in value since the early 1970s. Is that because being a CEO has become 1,000 times more difficult? I don't think so. It's a very gendered argument. It's almost always applied to women more than any other group. So I think we should lay it on the CEOs.
Yes. Well, it's because of your gentle and caring nature that we cherish that.
Yes. Yeah. I'm very prototypical in that respect.
Okay. And finally, what's going to happen with this report? What's going to be done with it and what might emerge out of it?
I think what is going to be done is that a younger generation of researchers is going to jump on this data and really do some really interesting work that's going to really publicize and popularize the notion that unpaid work is not only economically productive, but it's really socially necessary. And we need to pay more attention to that aspect of the labor supply, or we're going to be in trouble.
Of course, Trump's BLS may just throw this straight in the trash, I guess, right?
I think that's probably a very good guess.
Okay.
All the more reason to get organized.
That was Nancy Fulbright, Professor Emeritus of Economics at UMass Amherst and a Fellow of the Levy Institute, and one of four authors of a report published by Levy on valuing care work. Nancy Fulbright seemed reticent about answering what the monetary impact of their findings was. The report says that including a fair valuation of household labor would add 42% to the average household's expenditures for those without children and 99% for those with children. Of course, that's not real money, it's imputed money. But it is a measure of the magnitude of how much unpaid labor is done outside the money economy, 3/4 of it done by women. Some more detail on pay. I mentioned that childcare workers are paid less than parking lot attendants. In 2022, the most recent year available, childcare workers are paid $14.22 an hour, just under half the national average. Parking lot attendants were paid $15.01, not much more, but still more. And as Nancy Fulbright pointed out, animal trainers are also paid more than childcare workers. $20.11 an hour, almost $6 an hour more than people who take care of little children. That's it for me, Doug Henwin. Let's go out with this. Some of St. Rex, new from Logic 1000, real name Samantha Poulter, an Australian musician now living in Berlin. Till next week, bye.